Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studios, seventh floor of the Trib Tower. And my next guest is the author of an incredibly meticulously researched and put together book called Four of the Three Musketeers, The Marx Brothers on Stage. And it is an incredibly comprehensive history of the early act of the Marx Brothers, when they were putting it together for live audience, and the time, the 25 years that they spent on stage and in vaudeville and traveling around. And it doesn't even cover the movie career or the Broadway career. And it's an incredibly dense and wonderful book. If you are a fan of the Marx Brothers and you think you've read everything that you could possibly read about the Marx Brothers, because there's a lot of books out there, about the Marx Brothers, some of them written by the Marx Brothers. This thing is a gift if you're a fan of the Marx Brothers. The author is Robert S. Bader, and he joins us now. Robert, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Dick.
Absolutely. First of all, congratulations on the book. It is, it's just it's an incredible piece of work, and I know that this book came out of kind of your frustration of trying to discover, you know, that era, the vaudeville era, which seemed to be either not covered or recycled with old myths and stories, correct?
Yeah, I was a big Marx Brothers fan growing up, and I read everything. And I was a kid in the 70s when the Marx Brothers had that resurgence, and a whole bunch of books were coming out. And
yeah.
Groucho was still around doing talk shows and writing some things. And I just found the vaudeville stuff to be so fascinating, but it wasn't enough, and I wanted to know more, and I kind of saw the same, probably apocryphal stories being printed over and over again. I just wanted to know what really happened. And I started sort of collecting the information with never having the intention of actually writing this book. I figured someone else would do it.
Yeah.
It just didn't happen.
Right. And the book, again, is called Four of the Three Musketeers. And there is a website that you can check out, marxbrothers.net. And we have a link on our Facebook page at facebook.com/NickDShow. Robert, let's start out with your background.
Sure.
And I'm looking at some of the stuff that you produced, DVD releases, including stuff about You Bet Your Life, the Marx Brothers TV collection, the Honeymooners Lost episodes, the Best of Danny Kaye, Danny Kaye's daughter on the show a few months ago to talk about that release.
Yeah, Dina's wonderful. She's Danny Kaye's biggest fan and his daughter.
Yeah. It seemed that way when I was talking to her. She was a terrific guest. But anyway, your fascination, obviously, with show business began at a young age, because in the preface of your book, you talk about the first time your grandmother sat you down in front of a TV and you saw Monkey Business.
Yeah, I didn't know what it was at the time. I was completely new to the Marx Brothers, and you know, I picked it up in the middle and just couldn't stop watching it. And then, like any 8 or 9 year old kid, it was out of sight, out of mind. I didn't think about them again until I saw them again. And I said, gee, I better find out who these guys are. And it led me into this whole world of vintage show business. I actually knew a lot of old people as a kid who talked about things like this.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a blessing. I think maybe younger kids today should talk to older people about show business.
Oh, I agree. It's great too, because you know, like I'm in my 50s. I'm in my early 50s, and I think I'm just a few years younger than you are. And at that time, it was kind of like a really wonderful resurgence. You know, as you were talking about earlier, the Marx Brothers were, you know, in the 70s, the books came out. And at that time, a lot of the local television stations were showing like Our Miss Brooks and the old Honeymooners reruns. And, You Bet Your Life was on in reruns. And a lot of that stuff really captured my imagination as well. Not to the point where it doesn't happen anymore today.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is, when I was a kid, those guys were still around doing talk shows and being on other people's shows. Like, you'd see a Dean Martin roast, you'd see George Burns, or then they'd be on the Carson show. These guys were still around talking about the old days. And I can actually remember as a kid, the first time I saw Groucho on a talk show as an old man, it floored me, because I'm so used to seeing that young guy dancing around in animal crackers and horse feathers.
Yeah.
And there's this old guy in a beret, but he was still funny.
Yeah. I remember there was a time when Mo Howard was on Mike Douglas.
I actually remember that show. He did a pie fight.
He did. And Donny Osmond was the, I think, the guest host for the week. And he smashed a pie into Donny Osmond's face. And I think at one point he took out a big hammer and hit him over the head with it. And I vividly remember that, too. And that jarring moment, just like you said, Robert, that jarring moment of seeing Mo as a really old guy with the same haircut, but all gray.
Yeah, I remember he had gray hair and he had it combed back, and then he went into his mo bit and he just combed it forward, an instant mo.
Such great stuff, man. So from a very young age, you became kind of really interested and maybe even obsessed with this, with the old school entertainment.
Yeah, I think obsessed is a polite word for it, but yeah.
Can you remember when you first decided that you wanted to like really get involved in this and maybe write about it? What was the first time that you decided, well, I really want to invest myself in this?
Well, actually, I thought about it and I had another career going on. I was fairly busy and I just was collecting all this information, and I have a large collection of artifacts and ephemera and things like that. And I was just trying to sort all the information and put together the story. And along the way, I had discovered a whole bunch of really funny articles written by Groucho. And I just enjoyed them so much, and I thought other Marx Brothers fans would really like these. And I was really fortunate to convince a publisher in 1993 to put this out as an anthology called Groucho Marx and Other Short Stories and Tall Tales, which did well. And I got to put out a new edition of it in 2011 with some extra stuff that I either left out for one reason or another, or you know, new stuff that I'd found along the way. So that book gave me the idea that I can do this sort of thing. And as the years went by and other people who were writing books about the Marx Brothers came to me for information and for research, I was hoping that they would get the job done, so to speak. But it was always a little bit less than it needed to be. And I said, I'm going to just get it all. And I decided at one point to devote a couple of years to just doing the book, which quickly turned into 8 years. I say slowly turned into 8 years.
You know, the result seems like a book that took 8 years to write, Robert. It is so, I mean, there is, it is, I didn't even finish it. I'll be honest with you. I read most of it, but I didn't even finish it in time for this, for the interview. And I really wanted to savor it because there's so much stuff in it.
It's deceptively huge.
Yes. Yes, it is. Well, let's start kind of at the beginning of at least researching and getting this thing off the ground, this book off the ground. Let's talk a little bit about what you wrote in the preface there, which really kind of kicks off the whole thing. And it involves a city that's not very far from where I'm sitting right now.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
And it's Waukegan, Illinois. Tell us about how everything became sort of that Waukegan became like the epicenter for this whole thing.
Yeah, it's a strange place that I had never been before. I'd never even thought about going there. I'd always heard about it as Jack Benny's hometown,
right.
What it's mostly known for. But in every story of the Marx Brothers, there's this seminal moment that supposedly occurred in Waukegan, where Chico joined the act by surprising them from the orchestra pit. He supposedly paid the piano player a few bucks to let him jump in there, and he started throwing fruit at him, and it's a wonderful, crazy story. It just didn't happen, because Chico was actually working with another guy on the road doing another vaudeville act at the time. But I didn't know the date that they played Waukegan, so I wanted to know what happened, and the only place you're going to read the local Waukegan papers from 1911 is Waukegan.
That's right.
I'd asked, you know, I'd been in Chicago and Milwaukee a couple of times for other things, and I asked friends or colleagues to come with me to Waukegan to do a little Marx Brothers research. I got these looks like I had a third eye in the middle of my head or something. People say, why would I ever do that?
You know?
And eventually I just said, I'm going to have to get out there, and there's other cities in the neighborhood that I need to go to do some of this work. So I just booked a research trip starting in Waukegan. Well, I actually started in Chicago and drove to Waukegan. And I had this really strange thing happen at the library. This is probably what you're referring to in the book.
Yeah.
Because someone told me after I told the story that you must put this in the book. It's just too weird to leave out. I didn't know what data I was looking for, and I started looking through microfilm newspapers right around the time when they would have been doing this particular act. And I finally hit the newspaper I needed with the ad, and I went to write down the date that they played in this theater, and I printed the thing from the library printer, and it had that day's date on it, which I put in my Marx Brothers database, which was, of course, incorrect. But then when I looked at the date on the newspaper, the date I was looking for was July 13th, 1911. I had written down July 13th, 2011 because I miraculously discovered this date on its 100th anniversary.
Yeah, that's
which just really weird.
It's very, very strange. It's very strange. And then you just kind of did a similar, you had the luxury of having an air-conditioned car, as you say in the book.
Yeah.
But you kind of did the same route that they did through the Midwest.
Yeah, you know, I didn't know the order until I actually pieced it all together, but it seems the way that I traveled to these cities was pretty much the way they did, because the railroad train probably followed a similar route to what's now the highway system. And it was an enlightening thing because I realized how they booked their routes based on the location of the railroad stations. And you know, I went through most of Illinois and places like Aurora and Joliet and Galesburg. And then I moved on into like Davenport, Iowa, and keep going straight across Iowa to Nebraska. And I learned so much about the Marx Brothers just buried out there in libraries.
And this was in 2011, and you had already begun this. You had already had the Marx Brothers database, and again, as you said before, with really no intention of publishing, right?
Right. I've been doing this for so long. I started the Marx Brothers database on index cards in a little 3x5 card box.
Oh, man, you remember those?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I started doing this when I was a teenager, and that was over 40 years ago. So yeah. When I first got a computer, the reason I got one was to do this. I wanted to put this bunch of index cards in a computer.
You talked about this story about Chico joining the group, throwing fruit and all this other stuff, and then you found out that that is an actual fabrication. Where did these stories come from, these stories that weren't true, these stories that were repeated and fabricated? You know, in all your research, how did you discover where these things came from?
Well, a lot of the stuff that people accepted as the real history of the Marx Brothers came from a book that they commissioned in 1950 with a writer named Carl Crichton. They had this guy write a book based on their stories that they wanted to tell and see made into a movie. So they embellished a few things, made up some great stories, told some real stories that were very funny. But that book became the story for anybody researching the Marx Brothers, and a lot of it was just not true. Now, I also want to say this, Nick, because you said you hadn't finished the book. The book does take them through the Broadway years on through that publication in 1950.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, you know, the Broadway stuff is very important to me as well because it's also pretty undocumented. But the idea of the book being comprehensive is really comprehensive in terms of the stage career, and it touches on the movie career just as it needs to take their lives to 1950. Because I thought that that was a good ending point because it was the end of them as a team. The formal end of the Marx Brothers was 1950. The stories that they made up were not as good as the real stories in many cases. That was what was real eye-opener for me.
Okay. And now let's talk a little bit about the beginning. How did they get started on stage in the earliest days?
Yeah, Groucho, at the age of 14, answered an ad in the New York World newspaper, which I actually found. And he got into show business first, inspired by his uncle of Gallagher and Sheen fame, Al Sheen, his mother's brother. He started to have a little bit of success, and Minnie March, the famous stage mother of the Marx Brothers, saw that this was a pretty good thing, and she had plenty of kids at home that could go into vaudeville. Mm-hmm. And she, one by one, started putting them into the act. She put Gummo in, along with Groucho, in something called The Three Nightingales. They were getting about $75 a week, and she realized if there was a fourth nightingale, they'd get $100. So she put in Harpo, who couldn't sing a note. And she was not wrong. They got more money for being a quartet, even though he couldn't sing.
Yeah.
This was the way vaudeville functioned. There was a lot of opportunity because there were vaudeville theaters in every small town in the country, every big town too, but they weren't up to that level yet. And they played these small tank towns all over the country. There were eight acts of vaudeville on a bill. There were a lot of opportunities. There were at one point in this country 40,000 people making their living as vaudevillians. So she kept throwing these boys on stage, and they did okay. They were in rough shape in the beginning, but they eventually got pretty good.
And when did the personalities that we all know, the distinctive personalities of the four brothers, when did they start to form?
Yeah, gradually when they were a singing act, they started to put little bits of comedy into their singing act. And Groucho had this German character that he stole from Al Sheen. As they moved from the singing act into a comedy act, and Groucho played a school teacher, they started to develop these other characters. This is when Chico became an Italian. This is when Harpo became an Irish tough kid. And Gummo, originally the fourth Marx brother, really the second Marx brother in terms of the chronology, but the fourth Marx brother in terms of the hierarchy within the act,
yeah.
He started to play a young Jewish kid. They called it a Hebrew comedian at the time. And they worked that act for a few years, and their big breakthrough act was called Home Again, which they started in the fall of 1914. And that's when the characters became a little more defined. But oddly, the last one to develop the character that we know best is Groucho.
Is that right?
Yeah, his was the slowest progression because he continued playing the German character until it became less feasible because of the anti-German sentiment during World War I.
Right. Now, okay, so let's talk a little bit about vaudeville.
Sure.
And you know, there were just a few guys who were making all the money. The Marx Brothers, like many of the vaudeville performers, had to work with these gentlemen. They had no choice in the matter, and it wasn't the greatest working conditions.
Yeah, it was a totally illegal monopoly. The guys who were running vaudeville, basically three or four major guys, but E.F. Albee, B.F. Keith, Martin Beck, and a lesser-known guy named Morris Meyerfeld, who was Beck's partner. Vaudeville was broken into two halves of the country, and there were two distinct big-time circuits, the Keith Circuit in the east and the Orpheum Circuit in the west. They were actually in business together, running the whole country, and they fixed prices on the salaries, and they made all the rules. And the Marx Brothers, in the beginning, weren't quite good enough to get to that top level, but they did work their way up. There were also rules about playing for the competition, and they were probably too naive to know this in 1911 when they went to work for a guy named Alexander Pantages. People on the West Coast might even still see some Pantages theaters around, yeah. Like there's one in Los Angeles.
Yep.
Well, the powers that be in the Keith and Orpheum circuit didn't like to see acts working for Pantages, so they blacklisted them. Initially, they might not have even been aware of it, but eventually they became aware of it. And they worked the small tank towns for much longer than they should have, given how good they'd become. But eventually, they were making so much money for the competitors' theaters that the big-time guys welcomed them in simply because of economics. Mm.
So gradually they would work the circuit. Now, some of the classic routines and things that we've seen in the movies and such started to develop during their days on stage.
Yeah, you can see things from their earliest acts in most of their movies. A great example is they started off with that school act really in the summer of 1910 when they were the Six Mascots, sometimes known as the Mascot Musical Comedy Company, when they would throw an extra guy on stage, usually their uncle. That act developed to a thing called Fun in High School, which became a pretty big success for them. You could see them doing a classroom bit in Horse Feathers, which is based on that. It's just that they made it to college because they're in their 40s by that point.
Right.
They continued playing school children on stage well into their 20s. They had to get a new act because they were just getting too old to play school children.
Mm-hmm. And so the progression through the success in vaudeville leading them to stage and Broadway, how did that happen for them? Was it a gradual thing or was there a big break?
There were a couple of big moments that happened to them that weren't good. They did get blacklisted, as I mentioned, in 1911. They got blacklisted again in 1922 for going to England without permission. That's how strict the rules were in this monopoly. They would get the summer off, but if they were willing to work during the summer, it was expected that they would work for the big vaudeville concerns in the U.S. They would have to get permission to go overseas, and they didn't. So when they came back, they found no bookings in the fall of 1922, and they took a job in a summer review that was being worked up for a theater in Philadelphia called the Walnut Street Theater. They originally came on as one of about 100 performers in this show, and it developed gradually into their show, which they toured for a good year and then got it to Broadway. And people would think that they were an overnight success. This was after almost 20 years of struggle and hard work, but they were the toast of Broadway after opening night of that show.
Yeah, and it's all detailed. Those 20-something years that you're talking about are all detailed in the book. By the way, the book is called Four of the Three Musketeers, the Marx Brothers on Stage. And how did the transition go from Broadway and then to the movies?
Well, that's just really, really great timing for them. They had done three Broadway shows. They did I'll Say She Is, and then they had a new one called The Coconuts, which was followed by Animal Crackers. They were very, very successful, but the Broadway business, just like vaudeville, was very negatively impacted by the coming of sound movies. Vaudeville was in chaos from this, and the legitimate theater was suffering as well. And towards the end of that era, of course, you have the stock market crash and the beginning of the Depression. This is at the point where the Marx Brothers were looking to continue doing Broadway shows. Well, they were offered big money. $100,000 at the time was huge Paramount to shoot The Coconuts as a film, which they did. It was an amazing success. It was the first real all-talking musical. I mean, it was a pretty early, primitive film shoot for a sound musical. Mm-hmm. You could see how much the technology advanced by the time they did Animal Crackers. It's a much more fluid-looking film, and it doesn't have any of the technical compromises that The Coconuts has. But they were actually struggling with the legitimate theater. Each of their three Broadway shows had a shorter run than the one before it. So they recognized that the next move was theirs to make, and all the studios were looking for actors who could talk. And there they were. The hits on Broadway were coming one after the other. So it was a natural move for them.
And obviously a very successful one. This is a tremendous book, Robert. I can't wait to finish it. And I'm sorry I didn't finish it before the interview. But it's a tremendous book, and I can't wait to get back to it. Robert S. Bader is the author. The book is called Four of the Three Musketeers, and it's about the Marx Brothers on stage. And it's a great book. And MarxBrothers.net is the website. We have a link on our Facebook page. Robert, a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks a lot, Nick.
Okay, have a good one. All right, we'll take a break. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN.